The internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Why is that resurgence happening now? Why are workers now doing the kind of militant movement, demanding unions, going on strike, etc., etc.? Why?
That's Richard Wolff, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Richard Wolff on the resurgent U.S. labor movement. In 1970, unions represented about 30% of private sector workers. Today, that number is just 6%. As unions declined over the past half century, workers suffered. They were paid poorly. They lost health care, retirement benefits, and control over their schedules. Deaths of despair from drugs, alcohol, and suicide surged among blue-collar workers. And the bosses, the fat cats, they got even fatter. CEO salaries went into orbit. After being pushed around and taking it on the chin for years, unions are back. They are a powerful force for equality, elevating the wages of underpaid non-union workers. UPS, Hollywood, Detroit automakers, Starbucks, and other corporations are being challenged to raise wages and improve working conditions. Our guest today to talk about these issues is Richard Wolff. He's professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He's currently a visiting professor at the New School in New York. The New York Times calls him America's most prominent Marxist economist. And now, Richard Wolff.
I wanted today's presentation to talk about a resurging U.S. labor movement. I want to start with the chain of coffee shops, Starbucks. A huge corporation, very profitable, located not only across the United States, but in many other countries. Proud, at least here in the United States, of having blocked, prevented, avoided unionization, thereby able to get away with imposing working conditions and wages on the people who work in their shops, that are now no longer tolerated by those workers. It was in the year 2020, in British Columbia, up in Canada, that the first group of workers in a Starbucks shop made a union, fought for a union, won a union at their workplace. It wasn't until over a year later, toward the end of 2021, that for the first time in Buffalo, New York, another group of Starbucks workers fought for, got a union election, and prevailed, won that election to establish a union. Let me read to you the statistics of what has happened in the less than 2 years since that first successful unionization effort at Starbucks in Buffalo, New York. As of now, 448 Starbucks stores in 46 of the 50 states of the United States have filed to unionize, collecting signatures from their workers. 322 Starbucks stores in 42 states have won union elections. 81 of those elections were lost. A ratio of 4-1 winners to losers in Starbucks. I could go on, but I think the point is clear. Let me jump to something very different. Medical doctors, long resistant to any effort to unionize them, are now unionizing all over the country. Several hospitals in Queens, New York, have now organized with the Committee of Interns and Residents, a union working with SEIU, a major international union here in the United States. Boston doctors, the three public hospitals in the LA area, likewise, doctors all over the country unionizing. Let me take another example. Strippers at a strip club in North Hollywood pioneered. They were the first group of strippers to want and file for and get a union. And they recently were joined by the second group of strippers, this one at the Magic Tavern in Portland, Oregon. Wow. Let me continue. Auto workers, the UAW, confronting the big three auto companies in Detroit. The Teamsters, who won an extraordinary increase in wages at the UPS company, with hundreds of thousands of workers involved. Public employees, music workers at YouTube, employees at Microsoft, Alphabet, Google, and so on. High-tech workers, low-tech workers, journalists remarkably doing this around the country. And I want to end my survey, and I have not the time to go through it, but I want you to see we're talking millions of workers moving and responding when other workers make that decision to do likewise. I want to pick out one relatively small one because you're going to see what this group of workers did is becoming a pattern that is going to shake not only the labor movement in this country, but this country as a whole. San Francisco Bay Area. 125 years, they've had the Anchor Brewing Company, went through various names and ownerships, but became a staple for beer drinkers in the Bay Area and beyond. Well, a few years ago, they were purchased by a huge conglomerate, and they were run into the ground. And the workers at first reacted, watching the threat to their livelihoods of the way this conglomerate managed, I'm using that word with a certain tongue in cheek, this brewery known as the Anchor Brewery. So the workers decided to join a union. Yeah, part of this very process I'm talking about. And they decided to join a union famous for its militancy, the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union, the union that represents the dock workers up and down the West Coast, from California to Oregon and Washington, and into Canada as well. And they joined the union. And in retaliation, or at least that's the suspicion, the conglomerate decided to shut down the brewery. And then the workers decided to do something else. They decided they weren't going to let the company destroy their livelihoods. And so they decided to do something, and we're going to come back to this. The workers are going to buy the company. They're raising money, and they've raised many thousands already. They're working with a variety of organizations that now exist precisely to help workers do this because it's happening all over the country. Workers becoming their own bosses. Workers becoming not only the employee, but the employer. At the same time, they're overcoming the employer-employee division that characterizes, or maybe I should better say, haunts every other enterprise in most of the industries of this country. So let me turn next to answering a kind of obvious question. Why is that resurgence happening now? Why are workers now doing the kind of militant movement, demanding unions, going on strike, etc., etc.? Why? Well, as with all major social movements, the answers are plural. There's many factors that come together. So let me go through some of the major ones. First, we are living at a time, and we have been for the last half century, from the 1970s to today, a time of growing, rapidly growing, extreme inequality in the United States. We have been living through a redistribution of wealth and income from the bottom and the middle to the top. That's why we have the Jeffrey Bezoses and the Elon Musks and the people with more billions of dollars than they know what to do with, looking for amusements, while a growing number of people cannot do what we used to call enjoying a middle-class lifestyle, achieving the American dream, or whatever you called it. Our middle class has been eviscerated, weakened, deprived, assaulted from every side. As the joke goes, too much month at the end of the money. The second factor that is provoking and developing our labor movement resurgence was the pandemic. You know, the pandemic had a number of interesting shocks that were administered to all of us. Number one, all kinds of workers were told that they were, and I quote, essential. They were the people who kept this country going during a time of terrible sickness, death, and the threat of dying or getting very sick. They're the ones who couldn't stop working because they operated the food supply, the transportation system, the production of basic goods and services, including those that kept you healthy or safe. These people, many of whom are paid very poorly, were told that they were essential. And for a moment, the working class in America understood that it is essential, that what keeps this society going is the army of working people who get up every day and go to work 8 hours, putting in their time, using their brains and their muscles to make the system work. And when the pandemic was over, suddenly, no more talk about them being essential. The government stopped helping people get through a hard time. No one cared anymore. Getting through a hard time without a pandemic turned out not to be on the agenda of the United States, and workers felt aggrieved. Suddenly, workers, and this is the third factor, suddenly workers understood when the supports of the pandemic, you're essential. We're going to help you out. You don't have to pay your rent. You don't have to repay your college loan. We're going to help you out because we can, because we're a rich enough society to do it. All of the help we gave you, we're taking back. We don't want to give it to you just because you need it. We only want to give it to you in a dire emergency. You know what it did? It made the working class of America think. And they began to think about the last 23 years. And I want to review what the working class has actually gone through in those whole 23 years. And that's what was happening in people's minds, thinking about this. So here we go. We've had three economic crashes in these 23 years. At the beginning, in the year 2000, we had what is called the dot-com crash. The stock market fell apart, and we had serious trouble, not just on Wall Street, but spreading through the economy. A few years later, in 2008 and 9, we had an even bigger crash, came to be called the Great Recession. Millions of people lost their jobs. Hundreds of thousands of enterprises went belly up, bankrupt, finished. Terrible unemployment, terrible suffering, lives interrupted, educations interrupted. And then we had a third one in 2020, a collapse of our economy. We call it the pandemic or the COVID collapse. It was the third economic collapse in the 23 years of this new century. And it really walloped the American working class. To give you an example, in the period 20 to 21, 2020 and 2021, half of the American working class experienced some amount of unemployment. For some, it was just a few weeks. For others, it was the whole year, year and a half. Half of your workers lost their jobs, many of them not knowing whether they'd ever get them back, or if they got them back, under what conditions, at what rate of pay. The anxiety alone that this produced was a staggering blow. So we have an American working class whacked by three collapses in 23 years and all that goes with them. But I'm not done. Before the pandemic was over, the working class was hit with an inflation, rising prices. And let's be real clear here. The prices rose by all measures, more than wages did. If you didn't have a wage increase at all, you were simply stuck with paying higher prices. If you were among the few who got a wage increase, it wasn't big enough to keep pace with the prices. If you were a minimum wage worker, and let's remember the minimum wage in the United States, $7.25 an hour. That was last raised in the year 2009. It's now 2023. 14 years, every one of those years, prices went up. In the last few years, they went up a lot. But what did we do as a nation for the people on the minimum wage of $7.25 an hour? Our politicians, Republican and Democrat alike, Trump, Biden, Bush, all of them, they didn't do anything. And those in Congress, neither, no matter who ran the government. They didn't help the people on the minimum wage. And inflation hurt everybody, except, of course, the people who set prices. They were raising their prices. And because I'm an economist, I need to remind everyone, who sets prices in the United States? Employers do. It's not the job of employees to determine the price of what they help to produce. They're not allowed to do that. Employers don't call employees in to participate in deciding what to charge for whatever it is they help to produce. No, no, no. The employers keep that to themselves. It's an employer's prerogative. What's the percentage of employers in our population? Well, there's an argument among statisticians. Some think that it's about 1%. Others say, no, it can be as much as 3%. So let's be clear what an inflation is. That's when 1% to 3%, the employers, decide to raise prices that the other 97% of the people have to pay. There's nothing democratic about an inflation. There never was. It is the autocracy of the employer class that imposes inflations. Just like it's the pattern of investments and spending that gives us the crashes in 2000, 2008, and 2020. And now that we've had a year and a half of inflation, what have they decided to do about the inflation? Jack up interest rates faster and further than we've ever seen before. Well, you know who's hurt by rising interest rates? People in the middle and poor who can't afford them. Just like who's hurt by the inflation. This is so unfair, so grotesque, and it comes after decades of a redistribution of wealth from the bottom and the middle to the top. If you see it, and you understand it, and that's why workers are now moving. They're seeing it, they're feeling it, they're experiencing it, and they don't like it. Here's another reason for a resurging labor movement. And it's in a peculiar way the one you get some mainstream media talking about. They talk about it as, quote unquote, a tight labor market. Here's what that means, that the unemployment rate is low. Historically, we have 3.5-4% of our people unemployed, and that's less than we usually have. Capitalism isn't good at getting full employment, never has been. So why might it be a little lower than usual now? Well, the answer is prices having gone up more than wages, people at the top being able to hire people at the bottom at wages that have not gone very far, and not as far as the prices they charge, it's now interesting for them to hire workers. To say the same thing in simple English, the ratio between what you have to pay a worker and what you can charge for what that worker produces for you, that ratio has become very favorable to the employer, so they hire lots of people. It's the message capitalism has always given to the working class. You want a job? You work for me for next to nothing. You push your wages up? I react by threatening to take away your job. It's not fair. It's not just. It's got nothing to do with democracy. But it is the reality, the harsh reality. We have low unemployment because we've driven down the wages. That's why people who have a job discover that even if you have one, you're constantly sweating your financial situation, because the relationship between the wage you get and the prices you pay means even with a job, you're always under stress and pressure. So workers are reacting to all of these things and demanding a better deal from the employer. They're demanding a better deal from the economic system we live in. And they're forming unions in the hopes that that will help them do better. And it usually does. All the statistics show unions earn higher wages for their workers than the same workers get working for places where there is no union. That's why employers work hard to keep unions away. The National Labor Relations Board, even the New York Times, denounced Starbucks for all of the unethical, illegal, semi-legal efforts they went to stop the unionization. They spent a lot of money. It didn't succeed because of these factors that I've just talked about. What are labor's goals in this resurgence? What does the labor movement want? Well, the first thing it wants is to reverse 60, 70 years of decline. 60, 70 years ago, a third of American workers were represented by a union. Today, it's about 10%. And the line of decline has been almost continuous. So that's a basic demand to reverse the decline of the labor movement. A second goal is to motivate workers to use the weapons they have at their disposal. After all, employers have a lot of weapons. They can take your job from you. That's a big one. They can change, often by any whim they have, the conditions of your job. They can change the pay you get or don't get for your job, the benefits you do or don't get for your job. You understand? The employer has no end of weapons to use, which they do use. Workers have many fewer. But one of the most important is to withhold their labor. That's when the employer realizes that you may be having a nice office, a nice factory, a beautiful store, but without the people working, it's not worth anything to you. It's just a lot of bricks and wires, and everything depends on the worker and the work. But the strategy that labor is going to use to reverse the 50 years of decline, to motivate people to recognize and use the weapons they have, such as the right to strike. That means something is going to have to be done, which more and more workers are understanding. And this is a kind of understanding of their history. And I need to take 5 minutes with you to go over that history so you can understand what workers are coming to understand that is motivating their resurgence. After World War II, it became very difficult to be a union in the United States. That's why unions have declined. Yeah, they've been attacked by business, but they've been attacked by business before. Employers don't like unions, and that's not new. But employers upped their anti-union efforts and involved the government to help them squash the labor movement after 1945. And we have to understand it because it's going to determine whether the resurgence grows and becomes more powerful, how it grows, and what it's going to do to all of us living in the United States. So here we go, brief history. The great achievements of the 1930s were the peak of the American labor movement. Suddenly, in a matter of 4 or 5 years, the United Mine Workers formed an organization called the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And in a few years, in the depths of the Depression of the 1930s, the CIO, led by the United Mine Workers, organized millions of Americans who had never been in a union before, whose parents had never been in a union, to join a union. And they did so because the Depression was an awful time of suffering for millions of people, and they saw joining a union as one of the few ways they had to get through this awful time. How did those millions come to join the CIO? The answer was a powerful alliance between the labor unions in the CIO, the mine workers, and so on, and the following three organizations, two socialist parties and a communist party. These were powerful parties back then, with tens or hundreds of thousands of members, and an alliance was formed, often called the New Deal Coalition. An alliance was formed between the unions and the communist and socialist parties. And they went to the then president of the United States, a centrist Democratic politician, the equivalent then of what Clinton or Biden or Obama are these days. And they went to him and they said, this depression is really destroying the American working class. You have to do something about it. And the message that everyone in the room understood, even though they didn't say it, was, we voted for you, Mr. Democratic President, and if you don't do what we need you to do to help the American people, we're not going to vote for you again, and you're not going to be the dog catcher in Milwaukee, let alone the President of the United States. President Roosevelt wasn't stupid. He understood what was being told to him. This time it wasn't a corporation dangling a donation. It wasn't a rich person dangling a donation. It was millions of people dangling the fact that they would listen to the Socialist Communist Party and or the CIO and vote. So guess what we got in record time, 3 or 4 years, the Social Security system. Suddenly, the government decided it would help people who had given a lifetime of work to this society. When you reach the age 65, you will get a check every month for the rest of your life, no matter how long you live. That's our response to what you did. It said to every American, you're not now going to have to take care of your elderly parents the way you thought you would have to. To the older workers, it said, we're not abandoning you.